What I want to see if we can think about today is something that I've called clinical general semantics, and I want to explain a little what I mean by it. You warm? Yeah. Let's get the symptoms over, too. Let's start out by wondering a little bit about this curious institution in our society that is called the clinic. What are clinics? What are clinics for? What's the history of them? We always had clinics? You ever thought much about this? Have you ever pondered about the variety of them? They're medical clinics, of course. It's kind of startling to realize that the Mayo Institution is called a clinic, the Mayo Clinic. It is an enormous medical institution. And why don't they call it a hospital? They call it a clinic. There's something significant about this word. We have everything from vocational guidance clinics, reading clinics, speech clinics, hearing clinics, all kinds of clinics. We even have basketball clinics these days. They are diagnostic, they are evaluative, they are agencies of our society in which people can be relieved from the usual restrictions of etiquette. This is one way to look at it. When you go to a clinic, you can say things that you cannot say in the living room. Or if you do, you tend to bother people. When you go to a clinic, by the very act of walking through the door, you imply that you are ready to answer questions that wouldn't ordinarily be asked of you. The usual mode of behavior in our culture is one that includes, as we have discussed before, a resentment of criticism. And we don't like nosy people who ask questions that seem personal. But when you walk into a clinic, you put all that aside. You're willing now to be asked questions that are personal, that would otherwise tend to stamp the questioner as nosy. And you presumably welcome criticism by the act of walking in the door of a clinic. This is a remarkable institution. It is one of the kinds of institutions in our society that is the most conducive to sanity, to behavior unaffected by the usual blockages that keep us from realizing our potential for development, for self-realization. So clinical is a very fine word in its major connotations. But there are some things about it that it has some meanings that we also need to be warned about. I want to talk about clinics for a little while, and then I'm going to concentrate on discussing clinical behavior, what goes on in clinics that would be of interest to us as students of language behavior and general semantics, by talking primarily about a kind of behavior that has come to be called counseling, which is another, it is a very interesting kind of behavior which differs in many respects from the kind of behavior which is most common in ordinary social situations or in homes or classrooms or offices or department stores, for example. I'd like to say a few words, first of all, about who goes to clinics. Now, in order to do that, I have to limit myself a bit. I'm not going to be talking primarily about medical clinics, although I don't rule them out. It's just that I can't, don't have time to be very systematic in talking about all the various types of clinics. So I'm going to concentrate mainly on the kind that, where the major activity would be counseling behavior. But this might include medical clinics. I mean, a good deal of counseling goes on in medical clinics. It isn't always a major activity there. It includes much of what goes on in speech clinics. It may not be the major activity in some speech clinics. Counseling can be done in any kind of a clinic. It's most done in the kinds that are called psychological or child guidance clinic or marriage counselor clinics, mental hygiene clinics, community health clinics. There are all kinds of names for these things these days. But they are the ones in which people go not because primarily they have physical ailments, although this language is not very apt. And many of them who go to the clinics that I'm talking about do have physical problems. And they are important in some cases. But the main reason they're there that I want to talk about is that they need what we call counseling. Or they can benefit from it. Now, who goes to clinics and define the, with the word defined this way, with what I'm talking about defined this way, who goes to clinics? How do they differ, or how are they like those who don't go to clinics? I want to say something about this because I think we tend to assume that there is a big difference between people who go to clinics and those who don't. And I want to emphasize that there isn't. The fact of the matter is that when you get, I think, this kind of a curve, if you were to work it out, this humpy curve is a distribution of people who go to clinics. If you distribute people all the way from what you will call very poor adjustment to what you would call good adjustment. You get some very bizarre behavior in the clinical group, but it's a rather small part of the clinical sample that bizarre behavior is characteristic of. For the most part, it's practically an overlapping. There's no special difference between people who go to clinics and those who don't. I would like to make these curves, if I could be ingenious enough to draw it. Let's draw it something like, it's hard to do it. But I want to represent the fact that to some degree, people who go to clinics may be considered to be better off than those who don't. At least they go. They have the motivation to solve their problems that makes them go. And there are many people who don't go to clinics who should, according to the standards that are used by those who go, who have as much need as do those who go. There have been some fairly good attempts made to survey population samples of the population. One of these is a recent study reported in a book. It's called the Midtown Manhattan Study, in which, I don't know whether I have mentioned this to you or not, in which about 23% of the population sampled in Midtown Manhattan in New York were judged by a team, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, to be seriously in need of psychiatry or psychotherapy or something of this kind. Just bear with it. We will. Yeah, it's going to ruin the tape, but don't let that bother you. About 23% were judged to be, let's just say, real sick, real sad sacks. About the same number, or proportion, about a fourth, were judged to be real good, real well, and the rest were in between, taking aspirins. The people who don't go to clinics are about like those who do. You don't compare a clinical group with a sampling of angels. Just a sampling of average guys, and that ain't too awe-inspiring. So, when I talk about what goes on in clinics, I'm talking about you and me and our neighbors and friends and relatives. And I want to emphasize that. This is not something specialized. These titles, I was a little afraid and I wrote them down. Some of you who major in fields like art might think that we've gotten off the subject that you're interested in. In fact, some of the empty seats today make me wonder if the titles might not have had that effect. And that should be a lesson to us, if that's true, because don't let words fool you. That's what you're supposed to learn in general semantics. The word is not the thing. We're not talking about something specialized. We're getting down to what really matters to all of us. Primarily, we're going to be talking about problems that, or I am talking about problems, these problems which we deal with by means usually of some kind of counseling, and that word will get defined as we go along. That's not specialized either. You can't avoid counseling, getting into counseling relationships. You're going to indulge in counseling behavior, and that's one of the reasons I want to include this in the course. Every teacher is a counselor. Every preacher or priest or minister is a counselor. Necessarily, you can't avoid it. It isn't a question of are you going to do it, but do you know what you're doing when you do it? How effective are you? How sensitive are you? How skilled? Every parent is a counselor. Every friend is a counselor. You can't get away from counseling. And I think one of the most astonishing things that has happened that I know about is an idea has developed and been adopted by many people that counseling can only be done by counselors. It must only be done by specialists, by psychiatrists or clinical psychologists or by social workers or some other specialist. You can't avoid counseling. Now, this is a kind of behavior then which involves relationships, all of which involve communicative behavior, communication. So self-communication and also interactions between people who are communicating with each other. Much of what goes on in clinics can be talked about as communication. One of your books on the reading list by Reusch and Bateson is about communication and in psychiatry as communication. These problems involve the use and misuse of symbols and symbol systems, and disorders of the symbolization process, or inefficiencies of it, or whatever word you want to use to indicate that the symbolization function is not all that it might be in the situation. The processes that are involved in these problems are fundamentally those of abstracting and projecting and evaluating. And the behavior, whatever the behavior may be, which is associated with these things. This may be behavior like stealing, sexual promiscuity, or whatever. It's behavior associated with these things. It may be stuttering. It may be anything else. But you can't talk about the behavior in isolation from these other functions and factors. In the clinical approaches to these problems, then, there's a good deal of emphasis upon the observation and evaluation of the language behavior of people, so that the effective clinician, in the sense in which we're using the word here, is a very astute and shrewd listener to the language of the person with whom he is interacting. This is a different kind of a clinician from, let's say, most physicians or most psychologists, or even most psychiatrists, I would say. At least I have in mind something which makes me say that. The sensitivity to language that I'm talking about is somewhat different from what might be used. There's a great deal of emphasis in the attempt to help the individual to revise his language and his language behavior in a broad sense. That is largely what the clinical work is about, as in the book by Reusch and Bateson. The emphasis is upon changing the individual's ability to communicate. I would go beyond what they say to something that to me is a little more basic. The fundamental thing we're doing in the clinical relationship that I'm talking about is helping the individual achieve revision, primarily language revision. It's as though he had written a story of his life, if you please, and he's revising it now. He's rewriting it. And we're interested, too, in the related behavioral changes that go with it. I want to say just a little bit about the revision of language behavior because I want to emphasize it a good deal. People who come to clinics, so far as they are in need of linguistic revision, would benefit, as a rule, by decreasing, let's put it very literally, the sentences they make which have a negative connotation, especially a negative self-reference, and increasing those that have positive focus. In other words, it's a matter of making the most of what you have left rather than the most of what you don't have. It's a difference between the point of view from which you say that the glass is half full as against saying that that it's half empty. It's better to say it's half full than that it's half empty. Well, there's a great deal to be said about this. This is not Pollyanna language. This is not verbal bootstrap lifting. This is within the limits of a realistic frame of reference. The sicker the person, generally speaking, the more negative his language. The better he is, the more positive. There is a benefit to be gained from a shift in these directions, from abnormal to normal, in the language reference, in the terminology, if you please, in the kinds of statements made, in what you talk about. It's better to talk about your health than your operations. And I don't want to overstate this. Sometimes you must talk about your operations. I'm talking about your general orientation. What are you most likely to talk about when there is no need to talk about your operation? You talk about it anyway. It's better to talk about your abilities than your disabilities. Remembering again, there are times when you must pay attention to your disabilities in order to understand them. It's bad to harp on them. It's especially unhealthy to harp on them in vague and not very effective language. It does little more than keep you, let's say, emotionally stimulated about it. The less exciting part of yourself, so to say. It's better to be encouraged than discouraged. This, again, with footnotes. It's better to stress your potentials and your limitations. And so, incidentally, for a very important example, you will talk more about learning than you will about heredity. From the clinical point of view I'm talking from, heredity is all of almost no importance whatever to you. It is genetics is a very important science. I did not say genetics is not important. Not at all. I think it's terribly important as a science. I'm saying that if you are going to try to change your behavior, what you can learn from here on is much more important than the limitations that may be inborn in you. You will discover, you can best discover your hereditary limitations by trying to learn everything you can. And then when you find you have limitations, then it's time to ask whether they might be hereditary. They might not be. But there's certainly no point, nothing to be gained clinically. It would not be good clinical technique. I can think of nothing more inept for a professional clinician to do than to emphasize heredity. Unless you mean the positive aspects of heredity. But I mean counting for something like stuttering by saying that it could be hereditary. This is very discouraging. This emphasizes limitations, possible limitations. It's much better to test the theory that it might be just behavior that you've learned. You can unlearn what you've learned, but you can't undo what you're born with. Now, after you have lived your life trying to discover what you can do, you may, in the end, conclude that you have very great limitations genetically. But I wouldn't conclude this till all the data were in. And that means, essentially, that you'd never conclude it, you'd die first. Now, I suppose I seem to be expressing some kind of preferences for what to think. I don't mean to do that. I am trying to focus on kinds of language to speak, to use in discussing a problem. In our ordinary daily language, our folk language, if you like, and it's the language that we find spoken mostly by professional people, and it characterizes more than any other kind of language our textbooks, most of the sentences that are explanatory refer to pathology. When we are discussing problems that are clinical, pathology either of the physical tissues somehow, or of the personality, or what is fancifully called, I don't mean that in an imagine, let me erase that some people prefer to call personality structure. I think this is a little fancy is what I was trying to say. What I mean, and it's hard to convey. It's hard to talk at all when you start talking about personality. It's very difficult to know what you're talking about. It's very difficult to predict what anybody else is going to think you mean. What I was trying to say a while ago, and I think it is very important, is that when you talk about personality, you tend not, as a rule, to be saying anything descriptive about a person. It's almost all an inferential kind of language. Almost all of the statements are classificatory rather than descriptive. And when they are explanatory, they tend to be sentences which refer to constructs, to the beable part of our abstracting levels, what might be, to account for what we see people doing. They might have egos. They might have ids. Nobody's ever seen egos and ids, of course. But almost all of our language is like this. They're about what might be, the explanatory sentences. In the kind of clinical approach to problems that I'm talking about, well, most of the problems are found, I think, to fall between these two kinds of explanations. And to be explainable more readily, more economically, as patterns of behavior that have been learned under certain conditions that are usually highly modifiable. And it is very difficult in most cases of what we call behavior problems or emotional disturbance or speech problems, communicative relationship difficulties, to demonstrate any kind of relevant physical condition. And it's just about as difficult to demonstrate, it's probably more difficult, I say just about, because the tests we have, personality tests, are constructed on the basis of certain assumptions and in certain ways, so that if you give one of these tests to a sampling of the population, you're going to find a few abnormals. This is almost a built-in characteristic of the test, because it is constructed according to probability theory in its more basic stages. The sampling involved is such that it is fairly easy to demonstrate that some proportion of a sample, a population, has what by definition is called personality maladjustment. What that means, aside out of that, out of the contrived frame of reference in which the test belongs, is very difficult to say. So out of the frame of reference, and it's very difficult to demonstrate what you would call imperfection of the personality structure. It's quite easy to demonstrate learning, or to, at least it is rather efficient in a clinical sense to operate on the assumption that you're dealing with learning, with learned behavior, and with behavior that can be modified by learning. Don't believe I'm going to have time to start the slides, Louise, so thank you for getting the projector. I want to take a moment now. We've got a little time left. The alarm hasn't gone off. I want to emphasize what I've just said with an example. What I've just said is that most problems that we're going to be concerned with tend to fall between those that could be explained in any significant part on the basis of pathology, either physical or non-physical, whatever word you want to apply. The example, most of them fall between it. The example I want to give you is something that I was made, I've been aware of this for a long while. Once you get tuned in to something, you go about your business, you find yourself now and then in situations in which the tuning in pays off. You observe something that you wouldn't have otherwise had you not been tuned in. Well, last week I was in Detroit and I was in Albany, and in both places the tuning in resulted in my making some observations and doing some wondering that I might not have done otherwise. In Detroit, I was informed, talking with the director of the Rehabilitation Center, who was interested in the fact that they had been getting at their center quite a large number of children, and he was finding it very difficult to diagnose, as he said. Now this man is he's had some training in speech pathology and in psychology, and he is essentially a kind of person who is scientific. He doesn't like to use diagnostic labels if he doesn't know what they mean. So he was shying away a bit from calling these children aphasic or autistic or giving them any other name. And he had told his staff of workers, don't diagnose them. Observe them. Test, see what they can do. Form the best relationship you can with them and see what they do under the best conditions that you were able to make for them. He said what happened was, what's been happening case after case, is that the child comes in and, for example, you show him a cup and ask him, what is this? And he doesn't answer. So after he's formed a good relationship with the clinician, and he faces this type of a task or is in this kind of relationship, what is this? He says it's a cup. Now this sounds like a trivial example, but it illustrates a basic point. It's interesting that the parents, when they bring these children, tend to, and this was more obvious in the clinic in Albany, which was called a speech and hearing clinic, but it wasn't associated with a university or hospital. It was just, it was an old house at the edge of town, and this was operated by the Easter Seal Society, the Crippled Children's Society. And so I asked, who comes to a house like this with a name like this? What for? Who diagnoses himself so as to wind up here? Well, there it was very obvious. The parents were coming in with problems which probably most of you, with your training, would think should have gone to psychiatric clinics or elsewhere. But they came here because the parents said, when asked what's the matter with the child, well, I can't seem to talk with him. I say something to him, he doesn't answer. And they sometimes wondered whether they could hear, but yet they had evidence they could. So they were puzzled. It was a communication problem. Now, I'm afraid most speech pathologists would have been trained to assume that the child must be aphasic or brain damaged. But what was coming out of the work in both places was a suspicion that because of the way the children responded to what can be described as a favorable learning situation, was that they were dealing with kids who had learned to keep their mouth shut. There was no pathology at all, no brain damage. There was no emotional disturbance in any profound sense. But when they had talked, it hadn't resulted in a very favorable reaction from people around them who were important. It might have been quite an obvious kind of a reaction, such as, shut up, you. But it wouldn't need to be that. It could be something more subtle than that, or more complex. But anyway, these kids had seemed to learn that they better not talk. And as they found themselves into this situation, so to speak, they made their way into the relationship with the accepting clinician, They risked it and found that the consequences were all right. They were good, in fact, and so they began to talk quite well and hardly had to be taught at all how to talk. What the usual speech correctionists would have tried to teach them was irrelevant. They talked. It just had been conditioned. And you're reminded immediately of Skinner's pigeons. You can, reward a pigeon or not reward him, and you can do almost anything with him. That is within the limits of what pigeons can do. Well, it's probably very true you can do the same thing with children. And I think we are a little too diagnosis happy. And we tend to call people brain damaged, children brain damaged, or say, remind me of that next time, and let's gabble a little more before I get into the slides. I got something to tell you. Ask me about my father.